listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. This is the good doctor, Dr. Mike, sitting in for today, tomorrow, and Friday this week. So we appreciate the opportunity to speak with Tom's audience nationally and internationally, for that matter. But up first here, during the first segment, we have Barry Nolan. And Barry is a former newscaster for WBZ-TV in Boston, also a professor of journalism at Boston University. So without further ado, let's welcome our esteemed guest, Barry. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, Doctor. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you, Barry. Well, listen, obviously a lot of stuff happened there in the city of Boston last week, one of the premier marathons in the world, and the horrible tragedy that ensued afterwards. Tell us, first and foremost, Barry, where were you at the time when this happened at the Boston City Marathon?
I had finished teaching and was at my home in Newton, just about 2 miles from where it happened, just off the route of the race where it begins to go up Heartbreak Hill.
Wow. And when you found out, how did you actually find out?
Oh, I found out like everybody else, like through the news. And one of the things that has been very interesting, I teach a course in beat reporting, and it's been very interesting to have this class of students that want to, some of them want to go on and be reporters and work on news programs, to watch both how it was reported, get involved in reporting it themselves, but also see some of the ghastly coverage of this event that was happening in their own backyard, and to see who covered themselves with glory and who covered themselves with something else.
Sure, sure, no doubt about it. To speak more directly, Barry, too, because nowadays with the advent, obviously, of the Internet, with multiple cable stations, I mean, you're a professor of journalism, the way that a story is covered, so to speak, the beat, is dramatically different than it was decades ago. So tell our audience how that has changed and what does that mean for the future of journalism with respect to reporting news events accurately or inaccurately?
It was interesting to see how many people and how many news organizations followed this story basically through the Twittersphere. There was an awful lot of information that went through the Twittersphere, and a great deal of it just, of course, is wrong. One of the other things that played a big role in this, on the Friday night story, when there was the big shootout about 2 miles outside my window here, was that you can download, don't know if it's a good idea to say this out loud, but you can download onto your phone these apps that allow you to listen to police radio and first responder radio frequencies.
Wow.
Basically, once upon a time, there were plenty of ambulance chasers and, you know, firebugs that had police radios in their bedroom, and they'd hear a call, and they'd grab their camera, and they'd run out the door. But now, any reporter, any videographer, anybody that's driving the satellite truck can have one of these things on their phone that allows them to listen to all these frequencies. Some people use that responsibly, but some reporters were then, because they just wanted to do anything to advance this huge story, would report some of the police activities, police plans, police comments over the radio, or police locations, which had, if the bad guys happen to have that on their phone as well, it's not a good thing to be doing.
Yeah, now, and you bring up an interesting point, because that really brings up the question, Barry, with respect to the accuracy of the information and the inaccuracy and what can or cannot happen as a consequence of that. For instance, in the New York Post, I know they posted a picture of a two individuals who were quote-unquote Middle Eastern-looking individuals that they deemed were suspects, and they also reported that a Saudi man was actually in custody. It turns out that both of those reports were flat wrong. There was no Saudi man in custody, and the two people that they posted the pictures of were not clearly the Tsarnaev brothers. So speak directly to that, how with the rapidity with which things can be reported, that the inaccuracies could ultimately end up in one particular case. There was a Muslim woman, I believe, in Boston who was assaulted physically because they were blaming this on radical Islam.
Some of it is bad reporting that is made worse by the animus towards Muslim countries and the Muslim religion that some news organizations bring to their work. And but there was also an interesting example of crowdsourcing gone wrong. The Reddit crowd, Reddit does some very interesting things, but one of the other mistakes that was made in the sort of sleuthing that everybody was interested in trying to find the bad guys was Reddit found the story about a young man from who had a Middle Eastern look, who had gone missing from Brown University about a month ago. He's from Sri Lanka, and he bore some resemblance to suspect number two, the man that was on the run that had escaped from the firefight.
Correct.
And in the Reddit universe, it was widely assumed that they had identified the man in the white baseball cap, and it was this kid that had gone missing from Brown University who had been thought of as perhaps suicidal. Well, they realized eventually that this was not the right guy, and they were Reddit posted an apology to the parents of this young man who must have gone through additional pain after having their son go missing to have him accused of being the mad bomber, and then for him to for it to be realized that he's still missing, and sadly it's presumed the outcome will not be good. But even a crowdsourcing, bad reporting that is done with animus, and even John King, who I don't believe for a moment had animus towards dark-skinned men or towards the Muslim religion, did some bad reporting because he believed some previously reliable sources that in the rush of it all were just a little too quick to tell John King, we got him. Under John King apparently mistook that to mean we've got him, we've got him in hand, as opposed to we think we've got an ID on him.
Interesting. Let me ask you this, Barry. How do these news outlets operate with respect to on-the-ground reporting? Because I followed that Friday night manhunt very closely. I was home ill, and I watched the entire thing unfold. And I was going back and forth, just toggling between two news networks, between Fox News and CNN, just to see as it was occurring, who was getting what, what kind of information was becoming available to them. And it seemed to me, I don't know if it's because Fox had a local affiliate there, but they were literally on that street, 67 Franklin Street, and had video footage of it happening, as it occurred, versus when I was going to CNN, they were behind like this yellow tape and they weren't near the street. And it really took quite some time for CNN sort of to get the live feed that Fox did. So how does that kind of unfold with respect to journalistic endeavors?
Those kind of things depend on what you're driving and what time it is. In the real life world of that kind of news reporting, on a Friday night at that time of day, remember the MIT officer had been shot about 10:45.
Correct.
Well, on a Friday night, you don't necessarily have your A team in place on the local news. Local news, if you happen to be driving a microwave truck versus a satellite truck, it's easier and faster to be responsive to something that goes on the police radio. You know the neighborhood better. You've been there more often than CNN. The guy that was able to get them there, get the news truck there, is able to drive more quickly and get in place. And then you've got guys that are often are going to be on the job at 10:30, 11 o'clock on a Friday night that are not necessarily your most seasoned reporters.
No doubt about it. Well, listen, hey, we got to run now, Barry, but I appreciate your time on the air, and thanks for your perspective.
Thanks. Take care.
Appreciate it. Okay, Barry Nolan, former newscaster for WBZ-TV in Boston. We'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman program in a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Hey, welcome back, my friends. Dr. Mike Newcomb here for the Tom Hartman program, and the Freedom Lines will now be opened up. Let me give you the number. It is 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466. And we're talking about, obviously, what you could dub the Boston Massacre. Last week was horrendous, horrendous, horrendous. I couldn't believe what I was seeing unfold throughout the week. I mean, two bombs going off at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Absolute chaos ensued. People were running around frantically. Literally, limbs were flying in the air, shrapnel, glass, blood, people screaming. Just an incredible, incredible scene of chaos and destruction. And it's something that obviously is deeply imprinted in the minds of our fellow Americans. And then for several days, we really didn't have any clue with respect to who these perpetrators were, why they did this, how many people were involved. But I'll tell you, the one thing that really has transformed the way that we conduct these particular investigations is without question the neural network that we have. And I'm giving you a physician term here, a neural network. And what I mean is the following. Today, with all of the advanced technologies that we have, we're literally in your fingertips, in your hand, you can have a cell phone today. And that cell phone can now produce state-of-the-art quality videos. It could produce state-of-the-art quality photos. I mean, if you look at the megapixels, Eric, on these phones now, I mean,
you have
high-def
video.
They're like, yeah, you have high-def video, and there's like 10 megapixels with respect to a camera. I remember when I ran for office here back in 2002 in the governor's race, we had digital cameras back then, Eric, and if I'm not mistaken, this was in 2002, so you're talking about well over a decade ago, it was about 5 megapixels, and it was like a whole camera. Today, in a right. cell phone, you got twice the amount of megapixels in a cell phone,
right.
giving you incredible, incredible quality
resolution.
And resolution. And then the ability to take those pictures, it's not like the old days when you were kids, like you had a camera and you would take it down to the you know,
to have it developed,
the drugstore,
which took a week.
Right, take away for a week or 2 weeks before you got your pictures developed. These things are done and developed instantly and then can be shared instantaneously throughout the world, the community, within seconds. So what's fascinating about this is that we have sort of this neural network, if you will, this nervous system that once this event happened and people were taking the videotapes, they were taking the photographs, they were taking the audio, and then as the FBI and local and state authorities started to investigate this crime, they were in essence, Eric, able to go back and get all of this data, start putting it into a major database, and second by second, you know, have a timeline and different views, right? Because if you had security cameras in certain stores, you have sort of an aerial view.
How did these guys think they were going to get away with it with all those cameras and video?
Well, they were obviously very smug about it because according to the reports, the younger kid, the 19-year-old one, Jonar is his name, right? Jokar or Johar. I think it's one of the two. Jokar, he is the 19-year-old student. He was a student at University of Massachusetts, and he lived on campus. And from the reports that we're now receiving, he was completely nonchalant about it. He was apparently back on campus partying, maybe even getting high from what the reports say. He showed no type of remorse. He was not jittery. He was not paranoid at all. He just was going about his business as usual, as though nothing happened. So obviously he and his older brother, Tamerlan, the suspects in this Boston bombing, really just resumed their normal daily activities of living, acting as though nothing had happened. And we know that's the furthest thing from the truth. But the thing that fascinates me, Eric, is that these authorities were able then, like I said, to go back, because you have time imprints on all these digital photos too.
Right.
You know exactly the hour, the minute, and probably the second, right?
It goes down to the second it was created.
To the second that it was created. And it's like pieces of jigsaw puzzles. You can go back and put this piece of the puzzle here, this piece there. And then before you know it, that entire marathon, which is roughly, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours, depending on how fast or slowly you run, but they're able to go back through that entire route and have all of these cameras and photos and pictures pieced together in this mosaic. And then that's where they were able to essentially see that, look, here's where bomb one went off, here's where bomb two went off, and these are all the pictures.
It's like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
Once they lined it all up, they could see who it was. They honed in on it.
And some of those pictures were very eerie because there was one picture, I don't know if you saw it, where the younger Jokar Sarniev, the 19-year-old, he had the white hat on
backwards
with the black jacket. He was seen carrying a backpack along with his brother.
And they're walking single file.
Walking.
It was very suspicious.
Yeah, and then there's a picture of him walking away, and right there was that little kid, unfortunately, who died, the 18-year-old, and you see that backpack sitting right next to that little kid, and you see him in the background walking away from the scene. So that allowed authorities, obviously, to piece this together. And then there was another photo, actually, that a citizen took, one photo, and it showed everybody running from the scene, frantic and panic. And then there was the picture of Jokar, the 19-year-old, walking away, like very calmly, not running as though nothing really had happened. And it's very dramatic. When you see this picture, he just looks as though nothing has happened. And that, obviously, to you or to me or anyone or investigator, has to be a red flag. Why is this guy not tearing butt, you know, out of there to try to make sure? You know, I would be running. If you wouldn't, you think there's another bomb coming, or if two went off,
yes,
there could be more planted.
Definitely.
You're not just going to hang around there. So.
Well, I don't know. You know, there was a lot of brave people who ran towards.
Well, right, but
stuff.
This guy was walking away,
right,
calmly versus running towards. So his behavior was very, very suspect. So the authorities were able to piece together all of this digital information into one mosaic, and ultimately were able to target the two brothers. And at that point, they didn't really know who they were, because that's one thing the digital information doesn't give you.
Is their name.
And their name. And that's where the authorities finally said, you know what, we need to get this out. We need to get it out to the public, because once the public sees these pictures, then we'll be able to identify these people very quickly and then close the dragnet on them. Listen, we're going to be back with your calls, 1-866-987-THOM. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. You can give us a call at 1-866-987-8466. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today, tomorrow, and Friday. I'd like to welcome everybody back to the table. The Freedom Lines are open at 1-866-987-THOM, and we're talking about the Boston bombing. But, Eric, we were just talking very quickly about how this digital nervous system exists, and it allowed the investigators to piecemeal everything together one by one by one, and then create two suspects that they thought were obviously involved with the planting of the bomb. And also the other thing that gave it away, another piece of technology too that we didn't talk about that last segment before we get to the phone calls, is that the two brothers on, I think it was Wednesday night, or was it Wednesday night or Thursday night, I think it was Thursday night, late at night, they had shot that Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT,
cop.
Officer, security cop, assassinated him, shot him dead. Then they carjacked somebody's car and held
that guy was lucky. He didn't get murdered.
Well, and they held him hostage for a while. He must have been sort of ethnic looking, because according to the reports that I'm reading, they said that they didn't kill him because he was not American. So they thought that he wasn't an American citizen. But they stole that car, but unbeknownst to them, or maybe beknownst to them, the guy left his cell phone in the car. And these two, well, they're not kids, they're adults, but the 26-year-old Tamerlan and then the 19-year-old Jokar, they both apparently bragged to this guy, saying that indeed they were the Boston bombers. And all of this braggadocio and telling who they were, little did they know, or maybe they did know, that the cell phone was in the car. And what the authorities were able to do, Eric, then was to ping that cell phone repeatedly and be able to locate by, you know, pinging it and using the towers and triangulations, place where it was geographically. And then that allowed the local police, in this case the Watertown police, to get it there very quickly. And that's when this incredible shootout occurred. They were throwing pressure cook bombs and pipe bombs and explosives at the police. I mean, just absolutely insane scenario. But once again, the power of technology. I know a lot of times people say, oh, technology is horrible and it's making things worse, but it could be used for good too. And in this case, the power of technology was used to find out who the suspects were and ultimately to capture the two suspects. So that being said, let's go to the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-8466, and let's get your perspective on things that happened. And what better way to do that? Let's go first to Frank, listening on Free Speech, and he is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and apparently lives 5 minutes away from where that shootout occurred. So, Frank, welcome to the table.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was awakened Thursday night, about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, and there were helicopters circling my house with the lights flashing down.
Wow.
And I, there was a big commotion. There were, and then I turned.
Now, do you live in Cambridge, Frank? Frank, do you live in Cambridge?
I live in East Cambridge, right. Right
in East Cambridge.
From where the MIT policeman was. I can go there in 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
As a matter of fact, from where those two brothers lived, I can go across the street in another, say, 10 or 15 minutes, Norfolk Street, and be right in there. When I went by there today, there were two cruisers on each side of the street and another cruiser, sir, you're passing by. So they have a constant police watch there.
Wow. Now, when you saw those police helicopters and the lights flashing into your neighborhood, did you suspect that it was something to do with the bombing, or did you think it was just something that, you know, maybe routinely happens every so often?
No, well, I had no idea. I mean, I was asleep, and I woke up, and I said, maybe there is something that where they're chasing people around the neighborhood, you know, because they had the lights flashing on, you know. So,
right.
Yeah, I sort of thought that they were chasing someone, like, from the results of this, you know, case that was developing. But what really got me afterwards was the Friday morning I woke up, you know, we had a, because of Patriots Day, we had a trash day collection pushed back. So I wake up early and put my trash out early because I want to avoid the vandalism, people running by knocking over trash barrels.
Sure.
So I see the less time you leave it up, the less chance they have of, less time they have of doing it.
Uh-huh.
And then I came back and turned the TV on. They said, you're not to go out. Nobody's going to go. No, you can't. This is a lockdown. They use the term lock.
Right. And that lockdown applied to where you were, even though you weren't in Watertown, where the police.
Oh, it applied to just me. It was me, to Cambridge, Brighton, Alston, Newton, Belmont, and then later on, here's the twist of the thing. Later on, they locked down Boston altogether. So it was like a million people in this metro Boston area.
Wow, so it was an incredible lockdown. So what did you feel like, Frank? Here you are, you had the bombings occur on Monday. Now in your very own neighborhood, you got helicopters with lights and all kinds of law enforcement, you know, scouring the neighborhood. The next morning you're told you're on lockdown and you can't go outside of your home. What did that feel like to you as a citizen living in what's supposed to be the freest country in the world?
Well, that's where the problems really began for my part, because they said, well, and these guys must be on the loose. I mean, I'm still relying on the news reports like Barry Nolan just described, you know, confusing news reports, you know. And so I said, well, okay. And my she was going to go to work, you know, I told her, she, you know, and she got a call from her boss saying, don't come in. This is, we're locked down. We can't move. She lived in Arlington, which is outside of Boston and outside of the lockdown area.
Right.
So I started to think of it. Then I got a call later on in the afternoon, a robocall saying there'll be no trash pickup for the weekend. This might be going on for 2 or 3 days. And I said, holy.
Oh, sorry about that. We can't have
sorry.
You, can't have you say that there. So
you
we're
should
just
be sorry.
Gonna have to go to the next caller. But listen, people get animated about that. They're very obviously emotional about what's happening. But we can't use certain words on the air. So we appreciate the quick response. The quick responders there, Eric. Appreciate
yes.
it. All right, listen. Let's go back to the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-8466. Let's get some more perspective from some other people who want to comment. Let's go next to Peter. On the line, he's calling from WCPT in Chicago, Illinois. Peter, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Dr. Mike. Thanks for taking my call. Something's been bothering me since Friday, and I hope I'm wrong about this. The second suspect was caught within the lockdown zone. Is that right?
Correct.
No.
Yes and no. I mean, that we're getting things confused with Newtown and Waterton. But he was apparently right in that periphery, right around. He either was within the zone or right on the
just
periphery of
it.
The zone, just beyond it. Because I got conflicting reports. I heard of reports that the authorities had swept that home earlier and that they had found nothing. And then I heard reports that they had swept the house next to it and didn't go to the house that had the boat in the backyard. So there's conflicting reports, and that still has, to this moment, yet to be resolve. But clearly,
okay, so that doesn't make me feel any better. That was my question. Why would they lift the lockdown then if they hadn't checked it?
Yes, and I agree with you, Peter.
They missed it, and there's blood all over. Something is not
right. No, no, you're 100% right, because I thought the same thing. When I saw that and I was hearing the reports, I was like, wait a second. You know, how could you go to the house next door and sweep that house, and then you don't go to the very next house and leave it alone and then declare, okay, there's nothing here? So it was clear, though, that the gentleman who walked out of his house that had the boat in the back, when he walked out to have a cigarette smoke, he saw that in the boat that the tarp was flapping in the wind, that it had been released somehow, and that there was blood on the boat. And then that's when he approached his boat, went up and looked inside the boat and saw a pool of blood, and I think he might have even seen a body in there. And at that point, that's when he went back immediately into the house, called 911, and that's when the authorities converged on that particular home, which was 67 Franklin Street was the address at the time, and everything ensued thereafter. But you're right. I mean, why declare everything is okay and everybody can go outside? And boom, all of a sudden, now you've got them cornered, and then people are just frantic and confused at the time. So, no, I think that's a good point, Peter.
Yeah, right. I mean, why have the lockdown if you're not going to check everything within the lockdown? And
right.
If they did check everything within the lockdown, how could they possibly miss blood
on
the
boat? Yeah.
And it seemed to me that the guy that found it, it was in the lockdown, because he said it was after they released the people and lifted the lockdown that he
right.
went out there and noticed the blood.
No, I think it's a good question. I mean, I know in the aftermath when this 19-year-old kid was finally apprehended and arrested and taken to the hospital, there was a lot of celebration, and appropriately so. I mean, people were lining the streets and clapping as the cars with the flashing sirens and the policemen were going through. And, they, you know, obviously tremendous work by the officers and law enforcement. But it does beg the question, why was the lockdown lifted if, perchance, that home was within the perimeter of what was considered to be the lockdown homes, and that home had not yet been evaluated or assessed or investigated? So good point, and I'm sure other people are going to be bringing it up. So appreciate it. Thanks a lot there, Peter.
I think that's at this point. Thank you.
Okay. All right. It's Peter calling in from Chicago, Illinois, opening up another Freedom Line here live on the Tom Hartman program. We still got Mike on the line, Jerry, Sandy, Jerry, Frank, Grace, others calling in. It's 1-866-987-8466. That's 1-866-987-THOM. And speaking of the technology thing too, Eric, not only from the photos and the cell phone and the pinging, the other thing that was very instrumental in this technology was the police were able at nighttime to use the thermal scanner from the helicopter to look into the boat to see if there was actually a human being in there, and if that human being was actually moving. So, again, technology playing an incredible, incredible part.
And don't forget the robot.
And then they had the robot to go in to take the tarp off and everything else. All right, listen, we'll be back with more. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
To Mike Newcomb, sitting in for the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting from 1480 KPHX. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in. We're going to get to the Freedom Lines here in a quick second. But, Eric, I just want to clear up, one, the pronunciation of the names, because these are not names that we're accustomed to pronouncing. They're not very common in, you know, America and the English language. So the first brother is Tamerlan. He's the 26-year-old who perished in the gunfight, and some speculate he was run over by his own brother. I don't know if you heard about that.
I did hear that. I heard that in a rush to get away, he possibly ran over.
Well, apparently what happened, according to the reports, is that they had two separate cars. The brother, they had the carjacked, I think it was an SUV Mercedes, and then another car, and this firefight ensued. The brothers jumped out, you know, they were, you know, shooting the guns and whatnot, and then apparently the older brother, which we'll get to pronouncing his name here in 1 second, started approaching the police, firing, just like, you know, like the Terminator, just like walking directly, no fear, and just going out there and shooting. And then he ran out of bullets. And then at that point, that's when the police officers tackled him, and they were struggling to get him handcuffed. And then out of nowhere comes this SUV Mercedes ramming right down the road, full speed. The police officers scramble, The brother stays there in the middle of the road, and he runs the brother over and then drags the brother in the car for quite some distance and then stops at that point, gets out, and then he fled into the night, and they couldn't find him thereafter.
Well, you and I were just looking a few minutes ago at his death photo, the older brother.
Right.
It didn't look to me like that body had been run over or dragged.
Well, yeah. Well, that's hard. It's hard to say, but, you know, he had a big thoracotomy there, lots of blood and everything, and the bottom line is that photo shouldn't have been released either. That was actually in the hospital, and somebody, after they tried to resuscitate the older brother and were obviously unsuccessful, he's lying in some gurney, you know,
pretty
somewhere
gruesome.
Probably in the emergency room, and it's a very gruesome photo. I mean, not so much for me because I'm used to seeing all this as a doctor. So
it doesn't bother me either,
For somebody who's never seen that, it could be very gruesome, no question about it. So that should have never been released, and the hospital administrator or one of the head doctors denied any responsibility of anyone that he was aware of even taking a photo, let alone releasing something like that to the public, because that goes against all the medical ethics that we've ever been taught. You don't take pictures of patients, particularly after they've died in a tragic sort of way.
It's considered part of the medical record.
Yeah.
Right? You don't release that stuff.
No, that's just – that was wrong to do that. But so this is the older brother's name is Tamerlan. Well, I'm not saying it correctly. Tamerlan, and then the last name is Tsarnaev. So this is what it sounds like in sort of their language, okay?
Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
Okay, and then the brother, actually, 19-year-old, his name, his first name is spelled Dzhokhar, and then obviously the same last name, Tsarnaev, like Tsar, like a Russian Tsar,
right.
Aev. So this is what he would sound like.
Johar Tsarnaev. Johar Tsarnaev.
See, I was correct. Johar. It's like Joe and Har. Like, just think of it, J-O-E, and then Har. You activate your mic.
It's like a hard H.
Yeah.
Johar Tsarnaev.
Johar Tsarnaev, and then?
Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
All right, so there you have it. So that's how the names are actually pronounced. Okay, let's get back to the Freedom Lines right now. They're packed as we speak. Let's see who we want to go to first. Let's go to Mike, who's listening online in Washington, D.C. He's talking about people in wheelchairs being arrested. What's happening, Mike?
Hey, how you doing? I'm sitting right outside the White House in Washington, D.C. as we speak. I just finished watching about 40 people with disabilities get arrested for blocking the White House gates. We're with a group called ADAPT. It's a disability rights group. We do a lot of nonviolent civil disobedience. And people are upset with President Obama for reneging on a lot of promises and a lot of the policies that the executive branch has that keep people with disabilities in nursing homes against our will. And that's what we're all about, is we want people to live in the community and not have to go to nursing homes when they have disabilities.
Yeah, no, obviously I work a lot in the nursing homes. I'm a physician and do a lot of care for the disabled and the elderly and people who ultimately need nursing home care 24/7. What particular thing are you referencing that the president is not sympathetic to?
Well, there's a lot of instances, but for instance, the Department of Justice has not been very good at investigating when states spend more money on nursing homes than they spend on people with disabilities living on their own in the community. I'm someone who uses a motorized wheelchair, and the state pays for someone to come into my home and help me get out of bed in the morning and help me get dressed so that I don't have to live in a nursing home.
Right.
There's a lot of and the Department of Justice is supposed to enforce laws that keep states from putting people in nursing homes, but they've been doing a very poor job of doing it. That's one of many complaints that we had against the Obama administration. So 40 people just got arrested about 10 minutes ago outside the White House. I'm sitting in Lafayette Park right now.
All right. Well, listen, Mike, we appreciate you phoning in and giving your perspective on these things. Thank you. That's Mike calling in from Washington, D.C. I don't know. I have to say I don't necessarily agree with that phone call, because there's nothing that I know of, Eric, that President Barack Obama and this administration have said, look, we want to institutionalize people. We want to make sure that you don't have the opportunity to live in your home and live in, you know, as independently as possible. And
Wouldn't it be less expensive to keep somebody in their
home?
Of
course.
Than
it's,
run
much,
a big facility?
It's much less expensive to keep somebody in their home environment than it would be to institutionalize somebody and have them stay in a nursing home. I know here in Arizona, for instance, there are many, many Medicaid patients. As you know, access, we call it access here, Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment Services. But the access program here, I know for a fact, does everything that they can within their power that I'm aware of to try to keep people away from institutionalized settings and to keep people in their home setting with the appropriate resources and help and financial assistance that they would need to do that. There's no question about it. I mean, it's so much more money to have somebody in a nursing home.
It's a huge facility.
Yeah, well, it's a huge facility, but then you have to have 24/7 licensed nursing staff. You have to have registered nurses, LPNs. You have to have CNAs. I mean, there's a lot that goes into institutional care in that setting. So I'm not really quite sure. I let them go on the air because that's what we do with the Freedom Lines, but I'm not going to say that I'm sympathetic or I agree with Mike from Washington, D.C., that the Obama administration has been unsympathetic to the needs of the disabled. It very well might be the case, but I suspect that he's giving his unique impression of that through his own filter and his own lens. In any case, we'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom today, tomorrow, and Friday as well. And we have a special guest on the line right now. We'll get to the Freedom Lines right after that. But we have Van Jones, who is the president and co-founder of Rebuild the Dream. And we're going to be talking today about saving Social Security. And also last week, as we saw, the stricter gun control laws were obviously that was not successful with respect to the Senate. So we want to also talk about that as well. Van Jones, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, honored to be here.
Great to have you. So let's start with Social Security, man. Tell us from your perspective what's happening with the upcoming budget proposed by the president. We've heard a lot of things being thrown around. We've heard about the chain CPI. What's your perspective on the Social Security issue?
Well, I don't think it should be on the chopping block at all. First of all, there's a reason that we have a budget problem in America. But that's not because we've been giving too much money to grandmama. You know, it's not,
right.
We didn't break the bank helping grandma. We broke the bank with the Bush tax cuts and the Bush wars. That is the source of the problem. As you know, Social Security is not even a part of the budget, technically. And if you wanted to fix it, if you're concerned about its solvency, it's solvent through 2030 right now. So there's no urgency, there's no emergency. And you could easily fix it just by raising the cap on the wealthy. Right now, if you make $110,000 a year or less, your entire earnings are taxed to make Social Security work. But people who make more than that get off scot-free. Well, that cap could be lifted. And if everybody, and not just the middle class, if everybody had to have their earnings tapped, then the program's solvent forever. So there is no emergency, number one. It's not even a part of the federal budget, number two. And number three, if you want to fix it for the long term, you can do it by bringing the rich folks in, not by throwing a grandma under the bus. And
yeah.
We as progressives and as just decent Americans who can add and who understand math should be outraged that a Democratic president would even suggest that we put that program on the chopping block.
Let me ask you this, man, before we get to what the president's thinking with respect to compromise, from my understanding, it's about $112 billion of potential Social Security cuts. Before we get to that, though, you talked about the cap with respect to the affluent and the wealthy. It's now currently at 110. What would that need to be raised so that, as you alluded to earlier, if Social Security were to be kept solvent in perpetuity, what would that number have to be as far as an annual income taxable?
I've seen different figures, but anywhere from, I think, 210 to 300 would pretty much do it. But, geez, maybe we could have everybody pay a little bit less in if the wealthy paid a little bit more. There have been a number of different studies showing ways to fix it. The point is, people say, well, that's not likely. I mean, it's not going to happen anyway. Well, listen, no budget at this point, given how divided D.C. is likely to pass. So why not be the educator in chief?
Sure.
And actually point out that the middle class, and we've already paid the price for 8 years of George Bush reckless tax policy and foreign policy and letting Wall Street run amok. The people who had the party, who benefited from the bailouts and the bonuses and the tax breaks, those should be the people who we continue to ask to pick up the tab. We didn't go to the party, but we're getting stuck with the bill, and it's wrong.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, let's focus on this then, man, because as you had said in one of your press releases, I believe that you worked for the president, you voted for the president, but this does not, to me, according to the administration, they say this is a quote-unquote balanced compromise. Why are they adopting the approach that somehow or another this is a balanced compromise? What's balanced about it?
Well, you know, I did support this president, and I do support this president. But even a great president can make a mistake. And this is a doozy of a mistake to even begin to go down this road. I do think that you get into Washington, D.C., whenever I go out there, fly to D.C. from California, I feel like I'm flying backwards in time.
Sure. Oh. See, time travel is possible.
Exactly. So the elite consensus that congeals in Washington, D.C. usually congeals so far to the right that a balanced compromise from the point of view of the Beltway makes no sense in any barbershop or nail salon or bowling alley or sports bar or mosque or synagogue or church when you just talk to normal people about normal math. And that's why ordinary people have to get involved and speak out and speak up. We can't allow the Beltway crowd to drag this president further and further from common sense. It's going to devastate Democrats conceivably in the midterms, and it's wrong.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, look, you saw the president really trying to compromise with respect to the gun control issue. I mean, he really went out there and sort of evangelized that whole topic and crisscrossed the country trying to at least focus on the things where we had common ground, i.e. the background checks with 90% of the country behind that. So, and then you had the Tomey Manchin-led, Senate fight to get this through. Even when the president, Van, is trying to compromise and bending over bending over backwards, this measure still failed in the United States Senate. So speak directly to that, Van. I mean, how is it in America you can have 90% of Americans behind something so commonsensical as background checks on criminals and, severely mentally ill patients, but it doesn't get through Congress? What's wrong with Congress right now?
Well, for one thing, you have this is the filibuster reform that the Democrats blinked on. Coming back to bite us in the butt. The vast majority of Americans want it done, and frankly, the majority of senators want it done. But, we did not, however, fix a filibuster. And there are certain things now that have been put in place that have nothing to do with the Constitution. The Constitution does not say that corporations are people. The Constitution does not say that a minority can tyrannize the Senate on every issue.
Right.
But we've allowed these things to happen, and then we have to live in the world that creates. We're going to have to be as sophisticated as the system that we're trying to change, which means some of this so-called wonky stuff about, the minority rule in the Senate, we've got to take that on.
Sure.
Corporations being treated as people, we've got to take that on. And until we can get some of that stuff knocked back and knocked down and punish the people who hide behind these kind of rules, we're going to continue to see these frustrations.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, look, Van, you are a Yale-educated lawyer yourself. I mean, from my understanding, at the start of any new session of Congress, the Senate majority leader, does not that person have the right to sort of just say, hey, it's going to be 50% and that's it? I mean, is it as simple as that?
Well, it's not as simple as that, but it's not much more complicated. The majority leader can't do it on his own, but he can do it. The new rules can be set with a majority of senators. The problem is that you have some Democrats say, well, listen, we're going to be in the minority someday, and right. We will want to use a filibuster. Well, that's fine, but you can't abuse the filibuster. If you want to do a filibuster, do it the way that Rand Paul did it. You stand up and you call attention to the issue, and you stand on your feet, and if you get other senators who are willing to stand on their feet, you can keep it going. But you shouldn't just be able to put a post-it outside this majority leader's door.
Right.
And shut down the entire democratic process.
Right.
That's what we have right now. And the Democrats should have fixed the filibuster. And any of the senators who refuse to have that fix go through, we got to start looking at how you primary Democrats who are on the wrong side of guns, who are on the wrong side of the budget, who are on the wrong side of fixing the filibuster and the wrong side of democracy when it comes to corporate alleged personhood.
Right.
That's going to be the next step in this fight, is to step up and say there's going to be real accountability for people who go to Washington, D.C. and adapt to the dysfunction rather than fixing the dysfunction.
Talk to the hand, the face ain't listening. That's not really the way the founders envisioned democracy, right?
Not at all.
No. All right, listen, Van, as always, keep up the great work you do out there, and it was a pleasure and an honor speaking to you on the national stage today.
Thanks for the opportunity. Keep it up.
Okay. There you have it. Van Jones, president and co-founder of Rebuild the Dream. We'll be back with more of the Freedom Lines in a short moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, this is Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's get right to the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. First up in the queue will be Grace, listening on Free Speech in Los Gatos, California. I love when you have names in Spanish. It just means the cats, right?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I always wondered, like, Boca Raton. Doesn't that mean, like, the rat's mouth in Florida?
You know, I don't know.
I think that is.
The cats,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very upscale community from my understanding of Florida, but it's named, if you said it in English, imagine, I live in Ratsmouth, you know, community. Well, in any case, welcome, Grace. We digress.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Absolutely.
One of the main points, you know, that I wanted to make, well, there's a couple, real quick. I am not willing, as a U.S. citizen, to give up my potential for Miranda rights for Johar.
Right.
I'm just not willing to do it, and I'm really angry that his Miranda rights were delayed.
Yeah, and you know what? It's a very controversial topic, too, because the Supreme Court has actually ruled on this specific provision that allowed the government to sort of waive, at least temporarily, his Miranda rights. But speak more directly to that, Grace. Tell me, why do you feel that way? Because I agree with you to a certain extent.
Well, that was a very conservative Supreme Court.
Right.
And they have ruled that people are persons. And so I guess that means that when I speed on the highway, I'm not really speeding. I'm just really traveling at a higher rate of velocity.
Right, right, right.
You know, we can just change words around and think we can get out of the law. What is next? And then also, he was charged today with
weapons of mass destruction.
And I just think that it's so wrong. Like, did we march into Iraq looking for pressure cookers?
Right.
I just think that description should be very, very specific to, like, nuclear bombs or something like that, not pressure cookers, because now everybody that owns a pressure cooker, what, we own weapons of mass destruction? And I just see a real chipping away at civil rights for the little guy.
Remember, one of the big debates, particularly on the weekend talk shows on Sunday, was whether or not he should be declared, the other guy, he's dead now, but the living brother, Johar, should he be declared an enemy combatant? In other words, here he's sort of an enemy of the state, and then that would allow him, if he's declared an enemy combatant, to potentially be tried in a military tribunal versus the civil justice system.
And I just don't agree with that at all, because, well, the reasoning for that was because, he had traveled back to his home country, Russia, to visit relatives. And I just cannot tell you how many people that I know,
right,
me being included. My father was not a U.S. citizen. He fought in World War II. He was English. He migrated here. He never became a U.S. citizen. You know, and when I hear people say, you know, so am I suspect if I... which I have traveled back to England and Ireland and Scotland to meet my relatives. Am I now suddenly suspect because, the IRA is in Ireland and maybe I connected?
Sure. No, well, look, you bring up very valid and intriguing points, because the bottom line is this. Here you have two individuals, and let's focus on the younger one since he's in custody right now, Zohar Tsarnaev.
He's a U.S. citizen.
He's a naturalized U.S. citizen, and the question begs itself. If you are a U.S. citizen and you are suspected or charged with committing a crime within our boundaries, should you be afforded the same rights and privileges that are afforded in our jurisprudence system to any criminal that is suspected of a crime? Because the fundamental principle is he's still innocent until proven guilty, despite the fact that we might have overwhelming evidence, but we still can't treat him as though he is guilty, is kind of what you're saying.
Well, exactly. And also, what really drives me crazy is the Constitution does, and I'm not a big, you know, Constitution thumper, but I know it enough to know that persons that are taken into custody, it says persons. It doesn't say U.S. citizens. It's not exclusive to U.S. citizens. The Constitution applies right to anyone that we take into custody in this country. You know, and this is part of what makes our country great, and it just drives me, it just infuriates me when people think somehow that, oh, if maybe you're not born, or, you know, and then they will even get out of it with anchor babies, you know, like they'll try to just do anything to justify not giving full
right, not giving people rights. No, and that's the fundamental thing, is that we're all afforded the same rights regardless if you're a suspect or not a suspect in a potential crime. And you're right, there is a slippery slope that you could start going down if you start chipping away and wordsmithing things and, you know, trying to backdoor it. The backdoor approach to jurisprudence is not probably something that's in the best interest of this country. Listen, let me get to the other callers. I appreciate your perspective. Thanks a lot, Grace.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, it's Grace calling from the Cats, California. There you have it.
I wonder how they got that name.
Los Gatos. I know.
Was the town like invaded by a bunch of cats or something? Feral cats?
I know. It's strange. Like here in Arizona, we have like one of our biggest cities called Mesa, Arizona.
Table.
Yeah. It's like, could you imagine like calling it Table, Arizona?
Well, that probably has something to do with the mountain.
No, I'm sure. But it just doesn't have the same. When you say it in Spanish, it sounds kind of alluring and romantic. And,
right.
Wow, I'd like to go to Boca Raton in Florida. But if you said, hey, honey, how about a trip with the kids to Ratsmouth, Florida? It doesn't say have the same allure anymore. But, okay, I digress. 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. We're going to get back to the Freedom Lines here in a quick second, but this is a very, very important topic, because what Gracie was talking about was your Miranda rights. When we get back from the actual break, I'll tell you a little bit more specifically what the Miranda rights are and how they essentially are read, and then we'll talk about the Supreme Court ruling, which allows the government officials to invoke what's called a public safety exemption, okay? This was an actual case in 1984. It was a safety exemption to the Miranda ruling, and it was a court case, New York versus Quarles. That's Q-U-A-R-L-E-S. And very interesting stuff. We'll talk about it. And look, some of you might agree, some of you might disagree, but the great thing is we'll have the opportunity to discuss this on a national level. So stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and if you give us a call, you do not have a right to remain silent on talk radio. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. This is Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in. Before I get to the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-THOM, let me just talk to you about the Miranda rights, because that's something that the previous caller had spoken about, and this actually evolved from something that happened here in my home state in Arizona back in 1966. There was a gentleman by the name of Ernesto Arturo Miranda who actually had the so-called rights violated when he was arrested for domestic violence. So what ended up happening with the Supreme Court, there's not exact words. In other words, it's not a script that is word for word verbatim given to law enforcement throughout the country with respect to the Miranda rights. You have some latitude, if you will, to use your own language, but it has to obviously represent the true intent of what the Miranda rights are. So According to the ruling, the Supreme Court said that the person in custody must, prior to any interrogation, be clearly informed that he or she has the right to remain silent and that anything that the person says will be used against that person in court. The person must be clearly informed that he or she has the right to consult with an attorney and to have that attorney present during questioning, and that if he or she is indigent or poor and doesn't have the financial means or the wherewithal to hire their own private attorney, then an attorney will be provided at no cost to represent that particular person. So that is, in essence, what the Miranda rights are. The question now that is before us is, does every person who is arrested and accused of a crime, do they have a right to have those Miranda rights read and enforced and honored, or could there be potential exceptions? And that is exactly what happened on Friday night. As I said, I was home, I was ill, and I was watching this thing unfold when they had found out that this Zohar Tsarnaev was hiding in the boat, and they surrounded the house, and it was a standoff, and gunfire ensued, and all kinds of crazy stuff happening, and ultimately they were able to get a negotiator in there, and he finally agreed to do what the law enforcement officials told him, which was to lift up his shirt to make sure that he did not have strapped onto his body an improvised explosive device or a bomb or something that could cause even more carnage once he was arrested. But he was arrested, and according to the attorney general who was present at the press conference after his arrest, and then he was taken to the hospital, the attorney general at the time said that they invoked the public safety exemption rule. And just so you're aware of this, this happened in 1984 in a case known as New York versus Quarles. And in this particular case, a woman told the police that a man with a gun had raped her and that the man had escaped into a local nearby grocery store. The police came in, found the suspect, arrested him, and then ultimately handcuffed him and found out that, hey, guess what? He has a holster, but there's no gun. So the question is, where is this gun? So at that point, the police felt, Eric, there was a threat. You know, here's a guy who's arrested. There's a gun missing. We don't know if there's another person here. Does that other person have the gun? So the police officers felt, hey, do I read him his Miranda rights right now, or do I ask him, where's the gun? And is there an imminent threat to public safety that's immediate in nature? So what ended up happening was they asked him where the gun was. He told the cops where to find it. Cops got the gun, and then they read him the Miranda rights. So that's the question that we have before us, and in particular this case with Zohar Tsarnaev. Should he have been read his Miranda rights, or was local law enforcement, and for that matter, federal law enforcement officials, were they correct in invoking the public safety exemption? Okay. Now, we all know that the Constitution does not allow you to interrogate anybody, any suspect, if you will, without first reading them the Miranda rights that I just told you what they were. Okay. However, the court did say in this particular ruling, quote, and I read you, quote, from the case, the 1984 case, New York versus Quarles, public safety exemption is permitted, okay, it is permitted on procedural safeguards which deter a suspect from responding. Wait, let me say, as the court explains, it says, quote, procedural safeguards which deter a suspect from responding were deemed acceptable in Miranda in order to protect the Fifth Amendment privilege, which is the right to not accuse yourself or implicate yourself in a crime. When the primary social cost of those added protections is the possibility of fewer convictions, the Miranda majority was willing to bear that cost. Here, had Miranda warnings deterred Quarles from responding to Officer Kraft's question about the whereabouts of the gun, the cost would have been something more than merely the failure to obtain evidence useful in convicting Quarles. Officer Kraft needed an answer to his question, not simply to make his case against Quarles, but to ensure that further danger to the public did not result from the concealment of the gun in a public area, end quote. So, Eric, I guess it's an interesting question, because say in this case, we knew that there was two bombs that went off at the Boston Marathon, right? And now you essentially have a suspect incarcerated with handcuffs, right?
Yeah.
But you don't know if this person has a bomb in the boat. You don't know if he had a bomb in the shed of the house where he was hiding. You don't know if he planted improvised explosive devices. The question is, in this narrow sort of window, can the police first find out if there still is an imminent threat? And then once they feel as though that imminent threat is not there, then they can read him the Miranda rights. That's the question at hand.
Well, it kind of makes sense. You know, I mean, they were throwing bombs.
Right. Right. So that being said, let's see what the audience thinks. I think it's a fascinating question, to be honest with you. 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. So let's go first to, let's see here. Let's go to Tim on the line. He's calling in from Sirius XM Satellite Radio. He's in Fairfax, Virginia. Tim, what's your perspective on this?
Well, I think in this case, it was right to suspend his Miranda rights. And in fact, I believe, I know he can't be tried as an enemy combatant, but he can be held as an enemy combatant. And then after 30 days, somebody can file a writ for habeas corpus, and he would be in front of a judge. Now, I don't think we're worrying about prosecutorial issues right now. This guy, a first-year law student, could put away and maybe even get the death penalty. This is about getting information to protect the American citizen, and that's the primary role of government. So he does not, in my opinion, deserve the same respect or dignity as a common drug dealer would who broke the law and then should be read their Miranda rights so they can have an opportunity to not incriminate themselves. The other thing I'd like to point out, I'm not sure if a lot of the audience members know, there are thousands of people locked away for life who have served their jail term but were deemed not safe to go back into society. The example I will give you are pedophiles. There, and I believe they should be locked up personally, but there are thousands of pedophiles who have served a 5, 10, 15-year sentence, completely fulfilled their obligation, yet they were deemed unsafe, and they were locked away in mental institutions, never to see the light of day. And that takes place today in 2013. So
right.
There are certain instances where the public safety trumps it, but remember, we have habeas corpus, and he would be in front of a judge in 30 days.
Right. I think, you know, I understand what you're saying, but I also recall back, you know, in the Bush days, and we were doing sort of the Patriot Act, and someone could be declared an enemy combatant almost sort of willy-nilly, and then you could be rendered. You could actually be rendered to some undisclosed location, interrogated by military interrogators, subject to torture. And there were cases that we know of that I remember actually covering on the radio, Tim, where somebody was rendered, was considered an enemy combatant, had nothing to do with anything with respect to terrorism or plots, were tortured, and then subsequently released by the government and the military. And that is obviously something that we don't want to see happen.
Obviously,
we want to protect anybody from that.
Obviously we don't. But when you have a circumstance like this, when you know for sure these are the gentlemen that did it, I think we have an obligation to find out, is there any other assistance taking place in this country that we need to be worried about at the next soft target, large event that could take place? There are certain exceptions. I am the last person in the world that would ever say we need to give up our Miranda rights, ever.
Right.
If anybody is questioning the government in this radio station, believe me, it's me. But I also believe there are certain circumstances where we have to basically put it aside for a little bit of time, wait for that writ to be filed, habeas corpus, the guy's in front of the federal judge, and in this case, it's not about losing the case. I think it's quite clear this gentleman's going to be prosecuted successfully. It's about getting information so they're aboard the radio station you're at or the underpass that I happen to be going under.
Right. No, I agree. That's why I think it's an interesting perspective. All right, well, listen, Tim, I appreciate the call. Thank you.
I love the show. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That's Tim calling from Fairfax, Virginia, with some very interesting points. You can get to weigh in, too, if you'd like to. It's a fascinating topic. Topic 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466. But again, this is a very narrow window that the Supreme Court, when they ruled this in the New York versus Quarles case, is that this can't go on indefinitely. The police or the legal officials who are incarcerating that person, have that person detained, they have to specifically ask questions that relate to the immediate threat. So in other words, they can't say to Zonar Sarnaev, hey, you know, well, what did your brother do 6 months ago, and why was he in Russia, and who were the people that he were meeting? That's part of an investigation. But what they can ask is, are there any other bombs that are here in the nearby vicinity? Are there any other bombs that are deployed that could go off remotely? that would jeopardize the public safety. See, it's a very, very narrow interpretation, and you don't have forever to question the subject. It has to be done in a certain time frame.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, this is Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. The Freedom Lines are packed. I'm going to get to everybody at the apropos moment, but first and foremost, we have our dear colleague and friend Victoria Jones with Talk Radio News Service on the phone right now. So, Victoria, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
It's good to have you back here today. And what do you got on the agenda today for us?
Oh, there's lots going on. Joe Karsaniev, the surviving suspect in the Boston Marathon bombings, was charged today with using a weapon of mass destruction against persons and property within the United States, resulting in death. And also one count of malicious destruction of property by means of an explosive device resulting in death. If he's convicted, the charges could carry the death penalty. And this was a bedside arraignment in which a magistrate judge advised Sarnia of his rights and the charges against him. And in the affidavit accompanying the complaint, there are more details coming out about the evidence against him. And it's quite chilling, apparently. The surveillance video describes how the man that it refers to as Bomber 2, which is identified as Joe Karsaniev, walking down Boylston Street towards the finish line with the thumb of his right hand hooked under the strap of his knapsack and a phone in his cell phone in his left hand. And at one point, once he gets in place, he checks his phone and even appears to take a picture with it. And then he appears to speak on it. I don't know to whom. And then a few seconds afterwards, there's a blast. And every head turns to the east. And he's alone among the individuals, appears calm.
Right. Wow. That's
a blast is to the east and then calmly but rapidly walks to the west.
Sounds like some pretty incriminating evidence. Victoria, with respect to the death penalty, is that because this will be tried as a federal crime? Because I don't think there's no death penalty in Massachusetts, right?
That's correct. It's because it will be tried as a federal crime. There is no death penalty in Massachusetts. So if state charges are filed in the death of the MIT police officer, he would not receive the death penalty for that.
Gotcha. Yeah, very chilling information you're sharing with us. So what else we got there?
The Boston bombings even found their way into the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on immigration today. This is the second of the hearings on the immigration bill, which, as you know, was unveiled by the Senate Gang of Eight at 2 a.m. last Wednesday. And fascinatingly, a clearly agitated Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, suddenly yelled at Senator Chuck Schumer. Schumer was calling on critics to stop using the bombings from last week as a chance to slow down an overhaul of the nation's immigration laws. "I never said that," Grassley shouted, and he turned towards Schumer. "I never said that. I don't mean you, Mr. Grassley," Schumer told the Iowa senator, and he said he wasn't directing his comments at anybody on the Judiciary Committee, but Grassley was not happy about it.
No, I heard that audio too, and it was pretty provocative.
Pretty provocative, yes. Yes, you might say so.
Yes.
This is interesting. In West Texas, as you know, the fertilizer plant exploded. The president will be traveling to the memorial service there with Michelle Obama on Thursday. And you may remember when there was a lot of back and forth about who would vote for aid for Sandy relief, for Hurricane Sandy. And a lot of Republicans voted against aid for Hurricane Sandy. Well, some Texas congressmen have been requesting aid, federal aid, to help the victims and the town rebuild in West.
Interesting. Somewhat hypocritical.
They voted against Sandy.
Yeah, somewhat hypocritical. Let me ask you this, Victoria, with respect to what happened at that plant there in Texas. I know that there were more deaths. I think there was even more injured than there was in the Boston bombing. Is there any speculation that this also could be somewhat terrorist related? I mean, I know everyone's talking about the deregulation and the plan had not been visited since 1985 in the way that it was supposed to have been visited and inspected. But if that's the case, wouldn't that be a very soft spot for a terrorist to infiltrate and then conduct activities?
Well, this is the thing. They just don't know. I mean, it's still being treated as a crime scene, and you've got BATF there investigating, and they just don't know what was the nature of this explosion. And so they're being very, very careful about how they talk about it. They
Turn out, Victory, that this was not necessarily just an accident. That after this investigation is completed, this could be something completely different for all we know. We don't have any objective answers right now.
That's correct. We have no answers right now.
Interesting. All right, what else we got, Victoria?
There will be a vote in a couple of hours in the Senate, a procedural vote, to move forward with an online sales tax. If you buy something online, then you're possibly about to get taxed. The Senate is very much in favor of this, not so much in the House. And there's a huge fight about to ensue about this. eBay is emailing millions of its users, urging them to fight the legislation that would empower states to tax online purchases. And on the other side, in the other corner, Amazon is in favor of this tax.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Why would Amazon be in favor? That sounds a little bizarre that they would be in favor.
Well, Amazon apparently has plans to expand its network of physical distribution centers, and that would make it subject to state sales taxes under current law. So maybe it wants to even up the playing field.
Interesting. Wow. Listen, Victoria, thank you very much for your updates. We always appreciate it and enjoy speaking with you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, there you have it. Victoria Jones with Talk Radio News Service giving us updates on many, many things that are happening in our world at large. And clearly, as she had stated, Jozar, the 19-year-old
Jokar
Tsarnaev, he has officially been charged. And as Victoria said, he has been charged with the weapons of mass destruction, obviously the deaths that occurred ensuing to that. He could be charged and, if found guilty, could have the death penalty sentence at the federal level. And as she had also alluded to the security worker at the MIT campus who was assassinated, he'll obviously face charges on that, but that's a state-level crime, and that is not subject to the death penalty. So we'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman program in a short bit. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, the Freedom Express chugging along here, hour number 3, and we're going to get to your calls in a short bit, but we do have a special guest on the line. His name is Arturo Garcia, and he is editor of Raw Story, and you just heard us talking about that last segment, the explosion, the plant explosion in West Texas. So lots of questions still surround that particular plant explosion, so let's get right to Arturo as we speak. Arturo, how are you?
Doing fine. Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you, Arturo. So listen, tell the listening audience, because there was two major stories, well, a lot of major stories last week. Obviously, the Boston bombing story was first and foremost in many people's minds. But talk about the fertilizer plant explosion, because that kind of got lost in the backdrop, Arturo. But the amount of devastation and destruction was not only equivalent, correct me if I'm wrong, it was actually more than the Boston bombings.
I don't feel comfortable comparing running that kind of tally when you've got two tragedies of this magnitude. Mm-hmm. But certainly anyone who saw the video of the facility first burning and then exploding, I think a lot of us saw that video, that apparent film from their truck. And you saw the gigantic explosion and a child's voice, I can't hear anything. Let's get out of here. You know, that was as chilling as anything you'll ever see. But what came out over the weekend was the facility, West Fertilizer, got slammed by a lawmaker, Congressman Bernie Thompson, who's a member of the House Committee on Homeland Security. Called it, quote, woefully off the grid, end quote, because the facility was allegedly carrying or storing 1,350 times the amount of ammonium nitrate that it takes to qualify for federal oversight.
Right. So, I mean, but this is my question to you. When I was kind of comparing the two tragedies, it wasn't a quid pro quo kind of thing, but what I was just trying to bring to light was that this was equally destructive. This was an incredible carnage and a great tragedy for our nation, but I guess it didn't seem to get as much press as did the Boston bombings. And so I guess my question to you is, why is that the case? And secondarily, you know, with this, you said this incredible discrepancy about the regulations and not being investigated. Isn't it possible that this is maybe not just an accidental explosion? Could it be something other than that? What do we know at this point?
Well, federal investigators say they've identified where the explosion took place. They haven't identified the exact location. But I think that's one reason this might have gotten less coverage, is that it's just, this is something that you can argue might have been building. We're talking about a facility that was built in 1962. It was grandfathered in under state law. It wasn't even required to have air permits until 2004. In fact, it was cited, I believe, in 2006, in part for filing necessary documentation 2 years late. Yeah, and it was fined just last June for improperly planning to transport anhydrous ammonia. So this wasn't like the bombings where you had readily identifiable suspects.
Right.
Eventually, this was, you can argue, I mean, the end result of years worth of lack of regulation.
Sure. I mean, from what I understand, it goes as far back as 1985, 3 decades ago, when the OSHA, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, had actually conducted a specific review and inspection of that plant facility. So why is that the case, Arturo? Why did this facility pretty much go unchecked for almost 30 years for all intents and purposes, when they're storing materials that are clearly very, very hazardous and, if not looked at very closely, could result in incredible harm and destruction?
Well, as far back as 2008, when the president was still candidate Barack Obama, he talked about the chemical industry pushing back against tighter regulation.
And so that, you think, was the genesis of this?
I think it's one factor. I think that's certainly it. Unfortunately, it might have to take something like this to open up questions that you can argue should have been asked, you know, like you said, decades ago.
Why don't
state officials share those kind of documents with, you know, up the ladder?
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, from my understanding, this particular plant, the West Chemical and Fertilizer Company, actually only had a $30 fine for what was deemed a serious violation for storage of anhydrous ammonia. I mean, that doesn't seem to have much teeth in it if you're getting a $30 fine for a serious violation of a substance that could cause mass destruction.
I do want to double check that. I had it closer to 3,000 in the reading I had. But either way, for a company, you know, in that industry, I think the point stands. It's not going to do a lot of damage.
Right. No doubt about it. Well, what do we know of right now, Arturo, where this particular case stands from what you're understanding and the information that you have available to you?
I think right now investigators are at the starting point.
So, just early on in the investigation. And what about the community? What resources are available that you are aware of that the community can access, given the fact that I'm sure many people were displaced from their homes, and it was a small community, correct?
Yes. small, you know, I don't think there were more than 20,000 people, if that, in the community. Let's see. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's an awfully small community. Goodwill of West Texas has a donation, is asking people to donate goods. You can visit their retail locations in the area. I can give you the websites. It's goodwillwesttexas.org.
Goodwillwesttexas.org is where you can access that, correct?
Correct.
And what do you think this means for the deregulation debate, Arturo? I mean, as far as, you know, this not being expected for almost three decades, having very minimal fines that had no impact whatsoever in changing the way they conducted business, where does this leave this whole deregulation debate?
I think much like this investigation, this is going to be a long fight one way or the other. Certainly if you're part of the lobby that has been calling for tighter regulation on these facilities, you finally have a case study that you can not only sink your teeth in procedurally, but you have a vivid example of what can happen. You know, a nursing home leveled, the picture of the mushroom-like cloud or a fast food restaurant, you know, that video I mentioned earlier. But there's no reason not to expect that, you know, industry forces are going to resist any call for change. You know, they'll call this an anomaly.
Right. Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, listen, Arturo, we appreciate your time on the air today, and thanks for the updates. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Have a good night.
Okay, there you have it, Arturo Garcia with Raw Story. We're going to open up the Freedom Lines because I know a lot of you have been holding for quite some time here, and the number, if you just want to hop on board the Freedom Express in the remaining moments of the program, the next few segments, give us a shout-out at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466. And what we're going to do is get back to your comments about Miranda rights. Should the Miranda rights have been read to the suspect, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev? And we know now that those were waived, that they invoked a special public safety exception rule. But many of the people listening to this program seem to think that you're going down a slippery slope now, that if you don't allow those Miranda rights to be read, then how wide is that window when it comes to the public safety exception? Is that just for an hour? Is it for a day? Is it for a week? Could it be indefinitely? These are very good questions, which we'll answer on the rebound.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman from 1480 KPHX. Give us a call at 1-866-987-TOM. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. We're going to get to your calls right now. We're talking about Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the 19-year-old student from University of Massachusetts, the Dartmouth campus, who was cornered like a rat in a boat behind someone's house, then subsequently apprehended. He's now in custody. He's in a hospital in Massachusetts in the Boston area. He has been interrogated. His Miranda rights were not given to him at the time that he was apprehended, although he has now been formally charged. And obviously with those charges, I'm sure he's been read his Miranda rights now. But that was not done at the time when he was apprehended on Friday, sometime in the late evening Boston time. So we've had Friday, and then we've had Saturday, Sunday, today, Monday, and then finally the Miranda rights. So that's the question at hand right now. We're going to get to your calls at 1-866-987-THOM, and you could opine on what your particular feelings are with respect to that. But before we get to the calls about the Miranda rights, I do have Johnny on the line from Free Speech in Lamarck, Texas, and he wanted to speak about the police law enforcement aspect of Friday night's activity. So, Johnny, welcome to the table.
Okay, first of all, I want to congratulate you for having a Workers Independent News. That's part of your lineup. It's good to hear that service outside of our Pacifica radio station here in Houston, so I'm glad that they get an airing other places too.
Thank you, Johnny.
As far as Dzhokhar Tsarnaev goes, I don't have a problem with him being criminally investigated and prosecuted, because after all, whether or not it's for politics, you still have to pay the consequences of what you do, whether or not you agree with why he did what he did. But I also want to see this Obama administration Justice Department go after with equal vigor people who own industry, like in West Texas, where all those people died.
Sure.
That's criminal negligence, and in some cases you could argue that it's one form of terrorism, economic terrorism done by big corporations on working class.
Sure.
Especially in this Lone Star state I live in, where people are afraid to speak up because they're totally, our government here is totally against worker rights and unions.
Right, so, right. No doubt about
that. That being said, we have a bigger problem, I think, in the long run. We've got a bunch of 8, 9, 10, and 12-year-olds who are growing up under a new normal of little or no constitutional rights. When they get used to seeing in the movies and now on the news, with every turn, with every crisis, these anonymous Ninja Turtle-style riot-geared police storming the Bastille, so to speak, but not the Bastille, but their next-door neighbors. Mm. And it's nice to cheer the police when you think they're doing well, but I don't think that's enough to scream, to shout USA, USA in the Neanderthal style, because that just shows that we haven't learned anything.
Yeah, well, like I said, people were very excited that the suspect was apprehended, but I do recall as I watched that personally on Friday night, and they had just given the clearance that indeed Watertown was safe, that the neighborhood was surveilled, and that there was no signs of the suspect in the neighborhood, and then literally as that thing, that issue, as that was edict was issued, people started walking in the streets, and next thing you hear is gunfire just going throughout the neighborhood, and lo and behold, here was this kid holed up in a boat, and it wasn't safe necessarily to go out. So, you know, maybe the police didn't thoroughly investigate that particular neighborhood or missed something, or maybe that was outside the perimeter. It remains to be seen, but we'll follow up. So, Johnny, I appreciate the call. Thank you for calling in. That opens up another Freedom Line here on the Tom Hartman program. Let's go next, I believe, to Alan. Let's go to Alan, who's calling from Muskegon, Michigan. How are you, Alan?
Yeah, Mike?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I want to talk about this discussion of Miranda rights. I think it is a total misunderstanding of reality to assume that this college student who had recently become a citizen and therefore had to have studied the Constitution, among other things, undoubtedly including Miranda, wouldn't know that the Miranda rights are simply a reminder given to mostly ignorant people in order to remind them that they have the right to remain silent.
Right.
So the idea that it's being sold as something special, that if they get something from him without giving him Miranda rights, all they're doing is making their own case more difficult.
Right. If they were to get information prior to giving him the Miranda rights, because then what would happen is if they got information and didn't read him the rights, that could be deemed inadmissible in court. So that's why it's very important, not only for the rights of the individual being accused of a particular crime, but it's also important for law enforcement if they want to be able to use whatever evidence is gathered when they come to prosecute their case. So, you know, I totally understand your perspective on that. So I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot, Alan. Okay, that's Alan calling in. Open up another Freedom Line here at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, 1-866-987-8466. Although one thing I do want to differ a little bit with Alan on is that I don't think Miranda rights are only for people who are ignorant and don't know the Constitution. I think there are many bright individuals and people who are not per se ignorant, but need to have those rights read to them. Because it's not only, Eric, the right to remain silent. That's not the only thing that is given with respect to the Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. Anything that you say or do may be used against you in a court of law. Although when you see it in the movies and all, they say anything that you say or do can and will be used against you. But that's not really, because it might not be. That will be is, I think, a little threatening.
Well, it will be if it's incriminating.
If it's incriminating, right. But the way that they say and will be, I think that's a little bit of sort of histrionics and a little bit of drama. But you also have a right not only to remain silent, but also to consult an attorney before you speak to the police. And you could also have an attorney present during the questioning. So you could either get them through cell phone or a phone, or you could say, no, I'm not saying anything until my lawyer is here in person. And then on top of that, if you can't afford an attorney, then our nation says, guess what? You will have one appointed to you at practically no cost to you. And then if you decide to answer any questions without an attorney, you have a right to stop answering them at any time until such time you talk to your attorney. So there you have it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb, broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's get right back to the Freedom Lines. We got Jerry on the line from Long Island, New York, listening on WWRL, the affiliate out there in New York City. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call. Well, in addition to the Miranda rights issue, there's also a firearms aspect to this Boston terrorist bombing case, obviously, because as we all know, in the process of pursuing these two terrorist brothers or alleged terrorist brothers, as we all know, there was a firefight, and either as a result of the firefight or separately and apart from that, there was this police officer at MIT who was shot and killed in cold blood. And so in my opinion, there's something terribly wrong and something terribly broken with our nation's current federal gun laws when anyone, including now even foreign-born terrorist-minded individuals, can come to this country, and thanks to the NRA and the tremendous power of the NRA in our Congress, thanks to the NRA, these terrorist individuals can get their hands on virtually any firearms weapon they want, any ammunition they want, and use it against the police. And thank God that in addition to the explosive devices used at the Boston Marathon, thank God these two terrorist brothers never used the firearms they had against the marathon runners. And that leads me to a question. Where is Representative Peter King of Long Island, and who's also chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, where is he to speak out on the national security aspects of gun control, now that we've seen that even individuals with terrorism in mind can get their hands on virtually any kind of weapon they want, any kind of firearms they want. And if they buy the firearms at a gun show or through a private sale or they buy it on the Internet, there's virtually no questions asked. It's just ridiculous. I mean, I think we as progressives need to reframe the whole gun control argument in terms of national security, now that we've seen even terrorists minded individuals to get their hands on arsenals worth of firearms.
No, I hear you, Jerry. Well, listen, I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. And you bring up an interesting perspective to the debate, because what Jerry is actually saying is, I know we heard a lot about the Boston Marathon bombing aspect in the sense that two horrific bombs went off, and then also in the pursuit on Thursday night when the suspects were in Watertown and they were in a firefight with the police, they did have actual guns that they were using in addition to the explosive devices that they had. And from my understanding, the guns were not formally registered with them. So they had those guns illegally. So here we are on the heels of a very disappointing Senate debate in which the common sense regulations that President Obama and 90% of America was looking for with respect to background checks, in particular criminals with a history of violence and aggression and people who are severely, I repeat, severely mentally ill, that these background checks would serve to make sure that firearms and guns did not get into the hands of people who would use them in a destructive manner against innocent people. Well, as we all know, because of the filibuster rules, we talked about this with Van Jones earlier in the program, this went down in defeat. They were unable to muster up the 60 votes necessary to move the legislation forward. And as a consequence now, people like Dzhokhar Tsarnaev and his brother Tamerlan Tsarnaev, they were able to get guns on the black market pretty easily, apparently, and were able to use those weapons against law enforcement and obviously against innocent citizens. Somebody was assassinated, the MIT security officer, and that was, I believe, with a gun as well. So lots of the issues that we've been talking about here on the Tom Hartman Program are all sort of coming together. There's a confluence of all these issues with respect to constitutional rights, civil rights, the rights to, you know, own a gun under the Second Amendment, the right to not incriminate yourself under the Fifth Amendment. So lots of very deep, profound, constitutional issues that deal with fundamental liberties and freedoms are really surfacing as a result of all this that has occurred over the last week to two, or even longer than that. So these questions obviously remain to be answered. I'm sure they're going to be part of the public debate, the public forum for days, weeks, and years to come. And quite frankly, it's an honor and a privilege to sit here behind the mic and discuss these issues with you as a national audience. Okay. That being said, let's get back to the Freedom Lines right now at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. All right. Next up is Norm. Norm is listening in Chicago, Illinois on WCPT. Norm, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thanks, Dr. Mike. It's a pleasure listening to you again.
Thank you, sir.
You know, what I'd like to say is that it's interesting that the same Republicans that might, and I'm not really bashing Republicans, I've been Republican all my life until the last few years,
uh-huh.
but it's interesting how the thinking goes, is that they might want to totally protect the rights of the gun owner, give them whatever guns they want, et cetera, but at the same time, when here's an American citizen, as much as I'd like to see him, you know, taken out myself, et cetera, et cetera. He's an American citizen. He needs to be tried as an American citizen in an American court the way that I would want to be tried, or the way that you would want to be tried, or any other American citizen. That is much bigger than anything else.
Well, look, I agree with you, because a country that doesn't have fundamental rights and enforce those rights equally across the board to all of our citizens, then you don't have a country. You don't have an America. You don't have a constitution. You've got nothing. I agree. That is paramount with respect to the issue that we have here at hand. But what do you think about this public safety exemption, though? Because what it's saying is that if there is an immediate threat, okay, that's suspected. So in other words, this guy was suspected of bombings, and that he very well might have an explosive device on his person, or he might have, you know, explosives in the boat that he was hiding out in. Do you feel as though the authorities should have a right in that very narrow window to say, in this exceptional case, to interrogate that person before reading the Miranda rights to see if there's still an imminent threat? Or do you think that they shouldn't have that right, and they should have to say the Miranda rights first and then ask those questions?
No, they need to do that. Because
need to do what?
In a case like this, where it is a homegrown terrorist, that there might be another 1,000 people at danger. There might be 20 kids in a schoolroom that are at immediate danger.
Right. And so you agree that the public safety exception rule is probably okay, as long as it's very narrow. You ask a few questions, you get done with that, and then you go to the Miranda rights.
Yeah, and just because they find out those things may not be used against them in court necessarily. Like, we
right.
know where that's going. That's simply to protect more Americans.
Right.
And then you can say, okay, after he's read his rights, if he then releases that same information again, it can be used in a court of law then.
Right. And let me just give you one qualification. It's not only to protect the Americans, it's to protect the public, because there could be people there who are not Americans visiting or whatever. So it's to protect the public safety at large. All right, listen, I appreciate that. Thank you very much, Norm. That's Norm calling in from Chicago, Illinois, listening on WCPT. And let me just give you one other update on this public safety exception rule, because I know we've been talking about this. And the FBI, in a memorandum in 2011, they also had their own unique interpretation of delaying the reading of the Miranda rights and what that might entail. And they said in exceptional cases, the FBI concluded that continued unwarned, in other words, you're not telling them, interrogation, not giving them the Miranda rights, is necessary to collect valuable and timely intelligence not related to any immediate threat. And then a Department of Justice spokesperson went on to say that that particular framework, that guidance exists because, quote, the threat posed by terrorist organizations and the nature of their attacks, which can include multiple accomplices and interconnected plots, creates fundamentally different public safety concerns than traditional criminal cases. So, again, it begs the question, is the threats supposed to be immediate, the immediate vicinity? Is it a radius of a geographic distance? Or could it be a threat? Like we said, these are bombers, and they might have bombs at the world – well, not well. What used to be the World Trade Center. There could be a bomb parked in some truck somewhere throughout the city. You just don't know. So the question is, do you read the Miranda rights first, or do you diffuse, for lack of a better word, the potential threat that could exist and then go to the Miranda rights after them, okay? But – make no mistake about it, though, that even when the exception for the public safety rule is invoked, you cannot do it indefinitely. I think most people would agree that it can't be open-ended, it can't be indefinite, it can't be, you know, for weeks and days at a time. It really needs to be within a time frame that most people would consider reasonable. In this case, Eric, this guy, when he was apprehended, he ended up on a ventilator in the hospital, couldn't even speak. He had a neck wound, which they think might have been a potential suicide attempt. He might have tried to kill himself amidst all of this. And so now he can't speak. He's got the tube in his throat. The guy sedated. So it's hard to get anything from the guy at that point.
Right, right.
So you might have to say, you know, you can't just put an absolute time frame in the sense that you have to do it within a half hour or 5 minutes of arresting the suspect. Yeah, because if the suspect is incapacitated with a tube down their throat and on sedative drugs, they're not going to give you any information. You can't read them any rights.
Why can't you? Just because he can't speak doesn't mean he can't listen.
Well, he can listen. But now that he's awake and he's off the sedative drugs and he still can't speak, from my understanding, he's able to, like you said, hear the questions, listen to them, and then write the responses out. And I think that's what the interrogators were doing with that public safety exception rule. We're getting them to answer questions via writing the answers. And then after they felt satisfied that they got whatever they're going to get after from him, then they gave him his Miranda rights. Then they formally charged him. Okay, back with more of the Tom Hartman program in a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb, broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back. We are chugging along here. The Freedom Express pulling up at its final stop, its final destination for today. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. I'll be in the seat tomorrow as well as Friday, so we appreciate the opportunity as always. Let's get right back to the Freedom Lines right now and go first to – let's go with the Dave. Dave calling in from Waterford, Michigan on Sirius, but Dave is a retired cop, so very interested to hear the law enforcement perspective on this. Dave, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good to be with you, Dr. Mike. How are you today?
Oh, very well, very well. So, yeah, what do you think about this, Dave? Give us your perspective as a retired cop. Where did you actually serve? In which community?
It was here in Waterford in Oakland County. I think what may have been happening here with this Miranda issue, Miranda is a very specific and very focused ruling, which indicates that you have to read the person their rights before you question them. You have to give them the opportunity to, you know, maintain their silence before any questioning. And if you fail to do that, essentially you've jeopardized your ability to use that in the prosecution. Now, my take on this is that they already have what they need to prosecute this person, and there's probably nothing to be gained by reading the Miranda warning. In other words, if he lawyers right. up, then they have an issue being able to, you know, continue the conversation in order to find out some other nefarious stuff that may be afoot. Honestly, I don't think there's a cop in the country who's required to read the Miranda warning to anybody, but not doing so jeopardizes the ability to use any information you gain.
Correct, correct. Now, the other thing, too, which I did a little bit of research on this as well, Dave, does most of the law enforcement not only read the, you know, the Miranda rights, but also specifically ask the suspect, Do you understand this? Like, after each question, like, you have a right to remain silent. Do you understand this, yes or no? You have a right to consult a lawyer and be here in your presence. Do you understand this, yes or no? Because from my understanding, just reading it might not be sufficient. You also have to make sure that the suspect either agrees or disagrees with you in some type of verbal consent. Just by not responding to you doesn't mean that they necessarily consent, correct?
That's correct. That would not constitute a waiver. Typically, the local prosecuting attorneys would issue a card that you would read from, and if you read verbose warning from the card, then there's no question. And if you're later asked in court, did you read it? How did you read it? You pull the card out and you read it exactly as it comes off the card. Your Honor, this is exactly how I read it. It makes it very easy to testify in the future.
Just standardizing the approach. So listen, hey, Dave, I appreciate your perspective. Thank you for calling in and lending that law enforcement lens to look at it through.
Very good. Have a good one.
You too. Okay, let's continue onward. Let's go next to Glenn. He's on the line listening via Sirius XM Satellite Radio in Danbury, Connecticut. So, Dan, welcome to the table.
Well, hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A lot of topics here, but I'm going to focus just on one, which would be the method in which the police went door to door.
Correct.
And I think that it amounts to a person has a right to say no. And I'm not aware in this case whether there is a particular law that allows the police to, what they have done essentially is conduct martial law, nor that the governor himself invokes it.
Yeah, you know what? You bring up an excellent point. We lost you there, Glenn. I didn't hang up on you, but we lost you. But it's interesting what he's saying, Eric, because they declared a lockdown, quote unquote. They advised people not to go outside their homes. That doesn't mean that people couldn't go outside their homes, but that was the advisory that they issued to the public. But interesting. You know, if those officers and law enforcement is canvassing the neighborhood and they go door to door, house to house, you don't necessarily, without a warrant or anything, I guess you don't necessarily have to let them in. I mean, I'm no legal scholar, but I would
think that's how it works.
I would think that's how it would work. But now, I would think, though, if you say no, I don't want you to come in.
They're definitely coming back with a warrant.
They're coming back with a warrant probably relatively quickly. So, but it, again, another interesting point. Just because there is a quote unquote suspect loose in the neighborhood, does that give law enforcement the authority to just come to your house, knock on your door, guns, drawn, and say, hey, look, I need to check out everything in your house, right? Because that could be considered an illegal search and seizure, right? Well, but, or assuming that they don't seize anything, but what if they do that search and they go into the guy's cupboard and there's drugs there, or there's
Well, I think they have something called reasonable suspicion that allows them to get away with a little more.
But he brings up an interesting point. I think we should do a little bit of research for tomorrow's show, and we'll do that. We'll figure out what are the actual rules and regulations with respect to that. Is that a martial law? Did they have the authority to do that? Very interesting. All right, let's go to Aaron on the line from Los Angeles, California. How are you doing, Aaron?
Oh, I'm doing fine.
Good. What's on your mind today?
I'd just like to state, until we as human beings have as much empathy for the perpetrators of these crimes as we do the victims, we will continue to perpetuate these cycles of violence. And this stuff leads to, I'm sure you've heard them say ridiculous nationalistic things like, only in America when something happens like this do all the people run to help each other. That's nonsense, But this is the kind of stuff they're saying. All over the world people run to help, each other. And we need to have sympathy for these people. These people are just a product of our sick society that makes movies like Freddy Krueger and all this nonsense, demonistic movies, and we call this entertainment and we shouldn't watch it.
Right. Now, are you saying we should have sympathy for who?
For the perpetrators.
You're saying we should have sympathy for the bombers?
Yeah, that's the teachings of Christ. That's the teachings of Christ. Everybody calls themselves Christians.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate the call. I believe in Christ, too. But I don't know if sympathy is the word I would use for two guys who planted bombs that blew people's limbs off and killed innocent people. You know, redemption maybe, but I don't know about sympathy. That's something we could discuss tomorrow. But in any case, I thank everybody for participating in today's program. For those of you still on hold right now, we'll be back tomorrow at the same time. So, as always, tag, you're in.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.